Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I've been so excited about doing this interview because it is an absolutely gripping story so well told by the author. The book is titled, you've probably heard about it, it's been getting rave reviews, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of the President. And our guest this hour has been with us before. She wrote another great book, The River of Doubt, named a best book of the year by the New York Times Book Review. Candace Millard is our guest. She's a former editor and writer at National Geographic magazine. And she says that this book is about President James Garfield. And I don't think too many of us know very much about him, and he is worth knowing about. She didn't really start to write about Garfield. She didn't know very much about him, she said, beyond the fact that he had been shot. After 4 months in office, she was interested in Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. But when she was researching Bell, she learned that he had worked turning his own life upside down to try to save Garfield's life after the president was shot. She had never heard the story before, and she was fascinated, she said, that a genius like Bell would go to such lengths to help another man, even a president. So she wondered what kind of a man was James Garfield. And she learned that he was, without question, one of the most extraordinary men ever elected president. The more she learned about Garfield, the more she knew she had to tell this story. And many of us are very glad that she did tell this story. Candace Millard is our guest this hour. We will be welcoming phone calls. I hope some of you have had a chance to read this book, because I was sitting reading it last night watching the Brewers game. My husband was there, and I kept telling him all this information about Bell and this whole story, because we don't know much about it. It is just compelling. So I hope some of you have read the book. He will, as a result of my telling him, you got to read this, you got to read this. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. Candace, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, you just have written a whale of a book. I'm so glad you did it. And you could now do the book on Alexander Graham Bell, too, because all of these people are fascinating, aren't they?
They are. You know, I was stunned again and again and again the more I got into this story. You know, I was just captivated by each of these strange and sometimes wonderful and sometimes slightly villainous characters.
Mm-hmm. And you start the book, it's all also the circumstances. They're at the Philadelphia, the exposition, which mm-hmm. takes place in Philadelphia, and there are people there who could have been extremely instrumental in saving James Garfield's life. One of them tried very hard. One didn't accept something that he should have accepted.
That's right. So, it's a centennial exposition in 1876. It's this huge undertaking. And I was thrilled when I realized these three men had all been there. Garfield was there as with his family. And this exposition really sort of embodied who he was. You know, it's about scientific progress and education and just sort of expanding our minds. And sort of defined Garfield. Also there, was Alexander Graham Bell, a very young man who had this brand new invention that he was publicly displaying for the first time, the telephone. And of all people, the Emperor of Brazil listens to it and realizes this extraordinary invention, and it's understood immediately, and it just catches on like wildfire after that. Also there was Joseph Lister, this renowned British surgeon who had discovered antisepsis, and he had remarkable results in his own surgical ward in England. It had been accepted and adopted throughout Europe, and he was coming to the United States to beg American doctors to sterilize their hands and instruments.
And they sure didn't listen, did they?
They didn't. They were incredibly dismissive of him. You know, these are at this medical congress, and Lister had been invited as a keynote speaker in the surgical division. You had some very experienced, very well-respected doctors there who frankly didn't really believe in germs yet, and they thought that antisepsis was way too much trouble, and they had sort of their own methods. And at that time, the doctors talked about what they referred to as the good old surgical stink. You know, they wouldn't wash or change their surgical aprons. They thought the more blood and pus encrusted on them, the more experience it showed. And even those few doctors who were willing to try antisepsis had very little success for reasons that seem painfully clear today. They would sterilize their surgical knives, but if they dropped them during surgery, they would just pick them up and keep using them. Or if they needed to use both hands, they would hold the knife in their teeth and then continue to use it.
Yeah, they could have advanced medicine a lot sooner than they did. Switching to, and there's so many story fronts in your book, but switching to James Garfield for a moment, whose story we don't know very much about. And I kept thinking as I was reading what he said about slavery and that he had taken in a runaway slave, and he felt so strongly, and Frederick Douglass really thought the world of him, how different things may have been in this country during that long, horrible period of Reconstruction if Garfield had been allowed to be president.
He was, as you say, he was a fierce abolitionist from a very young age. He hit a runaway slave. He was a national hero during the Civil War as a Union general. Was instrumental in protecting Kentucky for the Union, and more significantly, as a member of Congress, he was instrumental in bringing about rights for freed slaves, including black suffrage. And Frederick Douglass gave a very moving campaign speech for him, and in fact was among the small group of people who were on the balcony when Garfield gave his inaugural address. So he was very, very progressive in this way.
Mm-hmm. And a story similar to Abraham Lincoln's in some ways, that he grew up these stories just blow me away. Dirt, dirt, dirt poor.
Literally, yes. He was he was born in a log cabin. In fact, he was the last president to be born in a log cabin in Ohio. Literally, oiled paper for the windows. They had nothing, and his father died before he was 2 years old. And but his mother and his older brother, who had begun working very early to try to, provide for the family, they always believed that James, whatever happened, James should get an education because he, this early on, had this incredible mind. So to put himself through college, his first year he was a janitor and a carpenter. By his second year, they had made him a professor of literature, mathematics, and ancient languages. By the time he was 26, he was a university president. He knew the entire Aeneid by heart in Latin. And while he was in Congress, he wrote an original proof of the Pythagorean theorem.
Oh, my goodness. I was just flashing an Alexander Graham Bell reading Hamlet's soliloquy to test his telephone of that fear, too, so they had something in common. They knew
That's right. They
knew the classics. And yet the other remarkable thing about Garfield is that he was a fairly unassuming guy. He never would use to his political advantage his poor childhood, make him look like some kind of guy who rose from the ashes. He was just a humble man in some ways, many ways.
He was never ashamed of his impoverished childhood, but he said, we shouldn't celebrate poverty, especially for children. And even though he was in Congress for 17 years, he never changed. His friends used to marvel at the fact that, even in the face of personal and brutal attacks, he would act as though nothing would happen and just sort of quietly and sincerely and earnestly, continue his argument. And he never had what he called presidential fever. He was surrounded by men who hungered for the presidency, and he never had that.
Mm-hmm. The only cause, and it's amazing how his political career took off, not because he helped it in any way, the only cause for which you write, he would not fight was his own political future.
That's right. He never campaigned. Again, he was in Congress for 17 years, and he was always asked to run, and he was willing, but he wouldn't campaign, and he always made it clear that he, you know, he was going to follow his own conscience and convictions, and if people didn't agree with him, they shouldn't vote for him.
Mm-hmm. The other figure who, of course, figures prominently is the guy who shot him. How do you pronounce his last name? Is it Gateau or
Gateau? That's right,
Gateau. And it's another one of those, if he had been institutionalized, history would have been quite different as well. This is a story of a guy, you know, who's obviously not well in his mind, but his life is just wacky. What he does is just this commune that he lives on, and mm-hmm. his father, who was also a religious fanatic. Tell us more about him.
So Gateau was sort of Garfield's mere opposite. He came from very humble origins as well, and his mother had died when he was young. But where Garfield met with success after success, Gateau met with failure at every turn. You know, he had tried everything, and he had failed at everything. He had tried law, evangelism, a free love commune, as you mentioned, and he had failed even there. The women in the commune nicknamed him Charles Get Out. But he was strangely intelligent and articulate. He lived this very solitary and peripatetic life. So his family knew early on that he was mentally ill, and they actually tried to have him institutionalized, but he would always just slip away and disappear.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there's a story of his sister. Do you know where in Wisconsin? His sister tried to take care of him some and was going to institutionalize him. He was living with the family in Wisconsin somewhere, and he escaped. She was going to take him to an institution in Chicago.
That's right. She had he had actually sort of threatened her with an axe, and that's when she knew, you know, he's not only sick, he's potentially dangerous. And, you know, it was difficult for her because she was his older sister. She had always sort of been a mother figure to him and tried to protect him and help him, and she and her husband were always sort of giving him money and giving him a place to stay when he needed it. So this is difficult for her, but she realized that it would be best for him, but he slipped away.
Chicago Republican National Convention, June 6, 1880. How does Garfield get the nomination?
So it's this incredible story. You know, he is there not as a candidate, not wanting to be a candidate. He's there to give the nominating speech for another man. And the favorite to win by far is Ulysses S. Grant, who's trying for a third term in the White House. And Garfield gets up to speak, and it's in this huge hall in Chicago, 15,000 people, and they're all incredibly noisy and raucous, and it's this chaos. And Garfield begins to speak, and it's this incredibly powerful and moving and eloquent speech, and the hall just begins to fall silent till all you can hear is Garfield's voice. And then he says at one point, "And so, gentlemen, I ask you, what do we want?" And someone shouts, "We want Garfield!" And the entire hall goes crazy. And then when the balloting begins, delegates begin casting their ballots for Garfield, even though, again, he's not even a candidate. And he tries to stop it. He objects, but the votes just keep coming until, you know, it's just this flood of votes finally, and he suddenly finds himself the Republican nominee for President of the United States.
And your historical research shows that he indeed did like to speak, didn't he? He liked to talk.
He did. He was an incredibly gifted speaker, but he himself jokingly referred to it as a fatal facility because he would speak all the time on the floor of Congress. And he was often asked to, but sometimes he would speak sort of longer or more often than people wanted. But he was known for being a very powerful speaker.
Huh. And describe, if you would, because we think of campaigns now when presidents are out there for 2 years in advance getting money and traveling all over the country. I found it fascinating that he's essentially gets the nomination and he's sitting on his veranda in Ohio and everybody comes to see him.
That's right. Well, you know, at that time, it was considered unseemly for presidential candidates to campaign. He was supposed to sit cross-legged and look wise, which thrilled him. I mean, the last thing he wanted to do was go on a campaign, which he had never done. So he had this farmhouse in Ohio, which he loved, and he had had built so he could spend time with his children and on the farm. And so during the campaign, he was there doing experiments with different types of soils and, you know, just running the farm and being with his family, and he was very happy.
Mm-hmm. And his campaign issues were what, Candace?
Well, he wanted civil service reform, and he wanted, you know, expanded rights for freed slaves. He's also, education was very important to him. In fact, he, in Congress, had been involved in developing the first Department of Education. So, and the hard money issue at that time. So all of those things are sort of what he believed in and what he thought he could do some good in as president.
And we need to talk about the meeting because Jouteau is thinking about Garfield and following him places. And the spoils system, in a way, figures into this interviewing of all the people who would like to have jobs, which Lincoln did as well. But Jouteau is there. Take us to Washington. He is president, and he has to have these mandatory meetings with office seekers. And Jouteau is one of them, and he becomes a real pest, and people realize that there's something wrong with him.
That's right. So this is the height of the spoils system, and you know, many Americans believe that they are entitled to government jobs, whether or not they have any credentials for them. And more than that, they believe they're entitled to make their case directly to the president himself. And so Garfield is forced to have office hours for anybody off the street, these office seekers, from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. every day. He meets with 100 people face-to-face every day. And even, you know, with all these people who have, you know, who are shamelessly campaigning for jobs, Jouteau stands out as particularly audacious. Garfield notices him as particularly audacious because he goes to the White House and the State Department every day. He had given one small and partial speech for Garfield during the campaign, had talked the campaign office into letting him. And he, because of that, he believes that he had single-handedly made Garfield president and that Garfield, in turn, should make him ambassador to France. It's just, he's completely delusional. And so he goes to the White House every day and the State Department every day asking for this position and becoming all the while more and more deranged, more desperate, until he finally has what he believes is a divine inspiration, a message from God telling him he should kill the president.
We're going to welcome phone calls and hear more of this story. We have yet to get to the actual shooting and who responded and Alexander Graham Bell's role in this and Dr. Bliss, who was ignorant. Ignorance is bliss comes from that. So we'll continue our story and take phone calls in a moment. Here's our number. Our guest this hour is Candace Millard. Her latest book is Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take a few phone calls for Candace. Sid on the road. Hi, Sid. Sid, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. I very much enjoyed River of Doubt.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm on a cell, and I'm a little, it's breaking up, but I'll do my best. It had been established well over 100 years before by John Hunter in London that going after bullets was a bad idea. I'm wondering why they did it.
Well, you know, they believed that, first of all, everyone thought that Garfield would die right away because they believed that the bullet had gone into his liver. It went into the right side of his back. And when he continued to live, they thought it must be near the liver and of that it was dangerous to him. And so they continued to probe and probe and probe. And in fact, you know, this bullet had not hit his spinal cord. It didn't hit any vital organs, and it had gone to the left, and it eventually insisted behind his pancreas. But they, out of fear, you know, this is one of these incredible situations because, as you say, I mean, this is a time when there were a lot of people walking around with bullets in them. You know, this is after the Civil War, but because Garfield was the president, there was this great fear that they wouldn't provide enough medical care for them. And in fact, they were providing too much and the wrong kind.
Isn't it ironic that it was Robert Todd Lincoln who called Dr. Mm-hmm. Bliss because he had been at the deathbed of Lincoln's father, the president?
That's right. You know, Lincoln was Garfield's Secretary of War. He was with him at the train station when Garfield was shot. And he couldn't believe that this was happening again. You know, he said, how many hours of sorrow must I spend in this town? And so he remembered Bliss because, as you said, he had been at his father's deathbed, and he called him. Unfortunately, Bliss was exactly the wrong man, you know. And his name, by the way, was Dr. Willard Bliss. His first name was Doctor.
Oh, my.
His parents had named him Doctor. But he, you know, Bliss saw in this national tragedy an opportunity for fame and power, and he seized control of the president's medical care, even though he hadn't been given that authority. He dismissed the other doctors, and he isolated Garfield in a room in the White House.
And how was Alexander Graham Bell brought in? He could have, if they had listened to him, he could have saved the president as well. How did he enter the picture?
So Alexander Graham Bell is only 34 years old at this time. You know, it's just 5 years after he'd invented the telephone. And he had quit the Bell Telephone Company. He had grown up into this big company with 600 lawsuits against it. And he wanted to invent, and he wanted to help people. And he said that the company was hateful to him, it fettered him as an inventor, and he quit. And so he, when he heard about this shooting, he knew that he could do something about it. This is before the invention of the medical X-ray. And it sickened him to think of these doctors blindly probing the wound, looking for the bullet. And he thought science should be able to do better than that. And so he invented something called an induction balance, which was basically a metal detector connected to a telephone receiver.
And they would not let him even look at the side of the body where the bullet was.
That's right. Two things defeated Alexander Graham Bell. One was they didn't tell him that the president was lying on what was very unusual at that time, which was a mattress with metal coils in it, which is, of course, going to affect a metal detector. And then Bliss believed and had publicly stated that the bullet was near the liver on the right side of the president. And when Bell came to examine the president, Bliss would only let him search the right side of the president's body. The bullet was on the left.
Sid, thanks for your call. Ron in Milwaukee is... Oh, Ron. Are you there, Ron? No, I'm sorry. Call us back. I mistakenly dumped the phone call. I didn't mean to. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Weren't there enough people around in the administration, people who are friends of the president, family members, who could have wrested control of all of this away from Bliss? Were there early warning signals that he may not have been up to the task?
No, no one understood that. You know, he was this well-respected doctor, and he, you know, he took advantage of, as you can imagine, surrounding a presidential assassination attempt. There's fear, confusion, chaos, and he took advantage of all of that. And you know, he literally put a screen around Garfield's bed. He wouldn't even let his Secretary of State see him for days until Garfield insisted, and then it was, you know, 5 minutes out and thank you very much, and back 5 minutes in and then back out. And he really isolated Garfield. He wrote a letter to the other doctors who had been there saying, you know, the president and I thank you for your efforts at this point, but there will no longer be necessary. And it came out later that he had never had that conversation with Garfield or the First Lady. He tried to say that, you know, we talked about it, but Lucretia said no, there was never any conversation like that. But he showed such confidence, and he just sort of took over, and everyone was frightened. And, you know, even though among the medical community, antisepsis was understood, it wasn't in the general public, and so they thought, well, we've got this very experienced, respected doctor, and so we're going to have to trust him.
And how long did it take the American people to accept Anaceptis after Garfield died?
It was immediately after his autopsy results were released. You know, the doctors themselves who were there for the autopsy understood right away the mistake they had made. You know, the hole in Garfield's back that they had thought was the track of the bullet was actually what they themselves had made, a path they themselves had made from their probing, and had filled with pus. And they saw the bullet was on the opposite side of the body and was insisted. And when the autopsy results were released, the American people understood right away that the president didn't have to die, and they understood why he did. And Bliss was publicly disgraced, and antisepsis was immediately and widely adopted throughout the country. Mm. So it was one of the, you know, very good things that came out of this incredible tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Ron in La Crosse, hi.
Yes, I wonder if your guests would know more about the bribery money scheme scandal. It did taint and add some blemish to James Garfield's career called Credit Mobiliaire. Mm-hmm. Gore Vidal touched upon it in his novel 1876.
Yeah, Candace touches on that too.
Yeah, the Credit Mobiliaire scandal. So this was a railroad company that had offered a good deal on stock to some congressmen, and Garfield had been one of those congressmen. He had turned down the stock, but he had taken a small loan, and he had paid it back and was sort of going on with his life, and then the scandal broke. He didn't have any understanding of sort of the, what was going on in a wider way. And there was an investigation, and he was found not guilty of any intentional wrongdoing, but it always deeply bothered him. You know, he felt that, you know, he hadn't done anything wrong, but the idea that other men wouldn't be so sure about his character, especially, just deeply troubled him.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron, for the call. Charlie in Green Bay. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, when I saw the write-up about this book in the New York Times a few weeks back, I made a decision that I will get the book, but I have not seen it yet. So I'm curious if the dramatic execution of Charles Guiteau is mentioned in this book at all.
Absolutely. The entire last chapter is about Guiteau's trial, which is this extraordinary trial. You know, the nation was heartbroken and furious that this had happened, and they were determined to see Guiteau hanged. And he mounted an insanity defense, which was sort of an early defense at that time, but obviously very, very controversial. And the country was terrified that he would be sent to an asylum instead of executed. And so there was this long trial. The trial transcript is nearly 3,000 pages long, and he's always sort of shouting things out during the trial. But he is found guilty and sentenced to death. And it's this extraordinary story that you may know about. He keeps thinking, I'm going to get a presidential pardon. Chester Arthur, who becomes president, must be very grateful to me. Again, he's very delusional and is going to let me go. And he even plans to run for president after he's let go. And then sort of the day before his execution, he finally understands that there's not going to be a presidential pardon. There's not going to be some great act of God to free him. And he kind of comes to an understanding with himself, but he asks one favor. He asks that he might be able to choose the moment of his death, and he's granted that. What he does is he wrote a poem, sort of a prayer, which they allow him to give to read on the scaffolding. He reads it in this sort of strange falsetto voice. He's sort of acting like a baby is what he's trying to portray, and then he holds the poem in his hand. And he drops it, and that's the signal to the hangman to hang him.
Mm. Thank you, Charlie. Judy in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Hi. I'm 60 years old, and I'm ashamed to say that I never learned this in school. Why is this not being taught in the history classes?
Well, you were going to do a book on Alexander Graham Bell, but you learned about Garfield. We don't know much about him. Why?
That's
good question.
Right. I think it's because he was in office for such a short time. You know, he was only president for 4 months before he was shot, and then he had this horrible, more than 2 months excruciating death. And so, and he, you know, interestingly, he understood that. You know, one of the last things he asked a friend of his who was with him as he was dying, he said, "Do you think I'll have any place in history?" And his friend said, "Yes, a grand, but a grander one in human hearts." But I think Garfield understood that he would be forgotten. And you know, the American people did, too. It's really interesting to read the newspaper accounts at that time because there's so many stories sort of lamenting the fact that not only would his presidency be forgotten, but he, as a man, would be forgotten. And no one would understand who this, you know, incredibly intelligent and broad-minded and kind man was. And, you know, his wife hated it because she hated all the paintings of him, all the portraits and photographs, because she said none of them captured him. If you see any picture, he looks sort of stern and serious, but he was actually this really outgoing, cheerful, optimistic guy. You know, he'd give you a bear hug before he'd shake your hand, you know, and he had this big booming laugh and these bright, sparkling blue eyes. He was just, you know, he loved life, and he was widely loved, and it was just, you know, heartbreaking to think that he would be forgotten. And, yeah, I think he has largely been.
Wow. I think this is fascinating. I'm really disappointed that it's not being taught in the school. This is a whole life history in this one book.
Well, thank you very much.
And I'm really going to pursue getting this book in the libraries, and I'm going to pursue getting it in the schools because I think this is fascinating, and I am going to go get this book.
All right, Judy.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, and it takes somebody like you, Candace, because you should be given due credit for weaving all of these stories together. You tell this story through eyes that are unique. You've woven together all of these stories, and nobody's done that before. And Judy is absolutely right. This is the way to learn history, because then you go, you read this book, and you say, oh, I got to learn more about Alexander Graham Bell. What a great guy. All this new information, I want to learn more about Reconstruction. I want to learn more about Chester Arthur. It just goes on and on.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, you know, speaking of Chester Arthur, to me, his story was one of the most surprising and incredible stories of the book, and I never expected it. You know, I remember when I turned in the manuscript, my editor saying, I never thought there'd be anything interesting to say about Chester Arthur.
The other thing, when you talk about the bear hugs and the kindness of James Garfield, he also experienced the death of children. And wasn't it, am I getting this somewhere else? Didn't he read Othello to his children because he wanted them to be completely aware of how hard life can be and also wanted them to know about death?
That's exactly right. Right. He had lost. He and his wife, they had seven children. They lost their oldest daughter and their youngest son to disease. And, you know, as anyone can imagine, it was devastating. You know, Garfield, when he lost his first daughter, he loved her. Her name is Eliza, named after his mother, and he had nicknamed her Trot. And he, after her death, you know, he wrote a letter to a friend saying, I don't know how I can go on. I'm just overwhelmed with grief, and I try to pour myself into my work, but I don't think I'll ever be the same. And then when he loses his son, Edward, he says, I didn't think my heart could ever be twisted this way again. And you know, so many families at that time had lost children. It you know, wasn't unusual. And having lost his father, you know, before he was even two, he always felt that absence of a father. And in fact, as he was dying, you know, it's one of the first things he thought about, and what he regretted most is that he was going to leave his children. In fact, he had, even though he was this very cheerful, optimistic man, he had long believed, and he couldn't explain it, that he would die an early death.
Mm-hmm. You've met some of his descendants who sound equally as lively, as caring as he was.
I have. I met with several of them. I've met them several times. In fact, I just saw them again in Ohio. Many of them are still in the Cleveland area. And they're wonderful. You know, it's really fascinating how, I mean, this is 130 years after Garfield's death, and so many generations And I'm talking, you know, great, 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 and even great grandchildren. And somehow, you know, they've held on to this incredible character. Yeah, they're really warm, gracious, welcoming people. And I just felt like I saw President Garfield in them.
And tell me what some of them have done. Have they gone into political lives?
Well, his children did. You know, his one of his sons actually became Secretary of the Interior for Theodore Roosevelt. And in fact, it's interesting because Theodore Roosevelt was the person who finally raised the Baltimore and Potomac train station where Garfield was shot. It's the National Gallery of Art stands there now. It was on the Mall. They were lawyers and architects and teachers, and they all went on to do, you know, wonderful things and just be good people and you know, great citizens.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls for Candace in a moment. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to have you. The book is Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. Candace Millard, who also wrote The River of Dow, we interviewed her on that book when it came out. This book came to our attention by the recommendation of Nancy Pearl, actually, who, when she was last on our show, just raved about the book. She loved it, and Nancy is our personal librarian, so what Nancy reads, I read, and not everything. She's a phenomenal reader, but Rhonda booked Candace, and I'm glad she did. It is a compelling on many fronts story. Two more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have an email that's come in, Candace, from John in Washington Island. He's reading your book right now, and he says the assassin lived in, let me spell this, I don't know how to say it, Port Ulao or Ulao, which is now Grafton, Wisconsin. The assassin lived there, and the house is still there.
Wow, yes. You know, Charles Guiteau moved around all the time. You know, he sort of took great pleasure in riding on trains all the time, never buying a ticket, moving from boarding house to boarding house and leaving just when the rent was due. And you know, and sometimes he would work as a bill collector, but even then he would just keep whatever he managed to collect. You know, it was just a different time in American history where people could do that and could get away with that. And so he was able to live this very strange, very solitary life. He was married for a brief time, but it was, you know, the story of his marriage, some of which I didn't put in the book. It was a distraction, but also it was just really difficult to read because he was very abusive to her, and she, you know, finally got away. But his own father, you know, his mother had died when he was young, and his father, as you had said, was this religious fanatic, and was very hard on him. So, you know, all of these things sort of came together to create this very delusional, very dangerous man.
Mm-hmm. We should also, and I hope that you do follow through on your first instinct. I'm glad you didn't the first go around, but write that book on Alexander Graham Bell. What a sweetheart of a guy this man was. He was just really, really smart. Again, if nobody had paid attention to his telephone invention at that fair where you opened the book, who knows what direction his life would have gone. I didn't know that his mother was almost deaf. His wife was deaf.
Mm-hmm.
He taught the deaf.
He was a teacher of the deaf. And that's what, you know, all through his life, that's what he really loved to do. You know, he was this restless genius, and he always had this, he always said this sort of this telephonic current moving in his head with ideas, and, you know, he would work late into the night. He wouldn't stop to rest or eat when he was working on something, and he, his only respite was to play the piano late into the night, but even then, you know, his mother called it a musical fever, because he played with such passion, but what he loved was teaching the deaf, and in fact, he would go back to it throughout his life. He would always have some connection to it, even as he was inventing other things. And incredibly, and I hadn't known this either, he When he was older, a man with the last name Keller brought his daughter Helen to meet Alexander Graham Bell. And Alexander Graham Bell introduced Helen Keller to her famous teacher, Annie Sullivan.
Oh, you have to do the book on him next. I'll look forward to it. I really will. And we need to hear the love story, but it takes a while to become a love story, of James Garfield and Lucretia, his wife.
That's right. They were very different people. As I said, Garfield was this very outgoing, sort of passionate man, and Lucretia was very quiet, sort of a private person. She was very smart. She and Garfield had actually met at school. Her father had helped to found the Western Reserve Eclectic Institute, which is now Hiram College, and she had been one of its early and few female students. And so, although they married, and she was very much in love with him, you know, he wasn't in love with her at first. He just wanted so much more. He wanted this sort of passion that she just couldn't give to him, and they were away from each other so much. For the first 5 years of their marriage, they're only together for 5 months because he was either gone fighting in the Civil War or he was in Washington in Congress. And then he had an affair. He met this young widow who was a journalist in New York, and he fell in love with her, and he felt that it was his only chance at love. But then he decided that he'd rather be respected, be able to respect himself, than be loved. And so he had admitted the affair to Lucretia, and she forgave him. But he thought, she's going to lose all respect from me. But incredibly, instead, what happened is that he fell in love with his wife. You know, he saw her not as cold and reserved, but as strong and wise. And slowly, over time, he fell deeply in love with her. And let me tell you, his letters to her are so beautiful, so soaring in his love for her. And he became to depend on her incredibly. And they had a very, very close and loving relationship. And that's, you know, another one of these tragedies of the story. He was only 49 years old when he died. And they had so much life ahead of them.
Are those letters published somewhere, Candace?
They are, and that's a credit to Lucretia, because many of these letters are very painful. But while Garfield wasn't sure what his legacy would be, Lucretia was, and she preserved all of these letters. In fact, she built, after his death, a fund was raised for her family, because they had very little money. And she took part of that money, and she built a wing onto their farmhouse in Ohio, and she established the first presidential library there, and she kept all of their papers. And there's now a book, which is very well done, called James and Crete, and it's just their letters to each other.
Oh, I'd like to read that. Ron in Milwaukee. Hi. Ron, are you there? All right, Ron, call us back. Our number, if you want to join us, is 800-486-8655. I want to talk about race a little more, because we're in a time in American history where things didn't happen and should have, and maybe we wouldn't have been through as many years of death and problems with race. You refer us to a meeting of, quote, colored citizens at the Cooper Institute in New York, filled an entire hall to overflowing. And the keynote speaker, the cause of the excitement, was Frederick Douglass, who talks about James Garfield. A couple questions. Describe that meeting for us. And what impact did Garfield's views on race have on the country?
So this is an extraordinary meeting because it is so integrated. You have a lot of black men, but you also have a lot of white men there. And they're all excited and riveted and wanting to listen to, you know, Frederick Douglass, who says, you know, I know Garfield, and we can trust him, and he has raised himself up, and where he's had great success, and we'll have more. Hancock, who was running against Garfield, who was a Democratic candidate, will go down and defeat. And yet there were great factions of freedmen. You know, when Garfield gave his inaugural address, there were freedmen openly weeping in the crowd. And during his campaign, you know, while again he's home in Ohio, and people would come to him. They called them front porch campaigns because he would go out and he would speak on his front porch. And a contingent of a couple hundred people came, and there was this choir from a black college, and they gave this beautiful performance. People were crying. It was so beautiful. And Garfield came out to talk to them, and he said, you know, I would rather be defeated and with you than against you and victorious. And it's absolutely part of who he was. And in fact, when he was shot, you know, there was a group of 600 black men who wanted to hang Gyuto themselves. And in fact, they had to guard the prison where Gyuto was for fear that he would be dragged out and hanged.
Jerry in Cedarburg, hi.
Hello. I'm an educator, history teacher, and I heard you make mention of the phrase, ignorance is bliss.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if you had a little more information to give as to how that phrase has really lost all reference, it seems, to the assassination of Garfield. And also being a history teacher, I thought that lady's comment about this is the stuff that we should be teaching to the kids is so true and right on, because that's a whole other issue about how history is taught to standards and testing, et cetera, that takes all the life out of it. And I think you are just giving life back to the subject, and I really appreciate it. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Jerry, very much.
I'm going to read your book.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you so much. And let me just say, as an American, as a parent, thank you for teaching our children. I'm sure you're a wonderful teacher, and I think we need to support our teachers more is what I think needs to happen. As for the statement, ignorance is bliss, it actually originally comes from an old poem, and I think it's from the 1700s, but it was brought back up after the autopsy results were released for Garfield, and again, everybody understood what had happened, and there were newspaper articles and articles in many medical journals vilifying Bliss and outraged by what he had done, and that phrase was used as the title of one of these articles, saying ignorance absolutely is bliss in this case. It was, and the worst part, it was sort of willful ignorance, because he should have known better.
And what happened to him?
Bliss, you know, the thing about Bliss you have to understand is the last thing he wanted was for Garfield to die. You know, he had too much at stake. In fact, he in a letter on White House stationery to a friend, he says, I can't afford to have him die, underlining each word. And he worked night and day, and he became very ill, sort of lost his health, lost his practice. And he adamant to the end that he had given Garfield not only adequate medical care, but exemplary medical care. And in fact, hands this huge bill to Congress for his medical services, which Congress refused to pay. They give him, you know, a small fraction. And he dies just a few years later.
We go to Kathy in Columbus. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I have a book that was printed in 1961. I don't know if it's still available. The name of it is Make a Joyful Sound, and it's the romance of Mabel Hubbard and Alexander Graham Bell.
Oh, wow.
And it's wonderful, and it mentions the incident with Garfield.
Oh, it is.
Wonderful. Yes, you know, they too, like Lucretia and James, had this wonderful love affair. You know, they were very much in love. She was, I think, 10 years younger than he was, and so very young. I think she was 17 when they met, and he knew, you know, he even wrote to her mother, I should probably, you know, marry somebody more my age and sort of who can support me in my work, but my heart is speaking, you know, and I love this woman, and she was a wonderful partner to him throughout their lives, and in fact, she died soon after he did, even though he was so much older than she was. She I think died 6 months later.
Hmm. And what about the relationship? I was interested and thought there might be more to this when Abraham Lincoln told Garfield that he needed him in Congress.
Mm-hmm. He did. You know, Garfield felt very passionately about the Civil War, both in keeping the country together and absolutely about emancipation. And he had this small regiment, the 42nd, made up largely of students from his old college, and he wanted to be with them. He wanted to be fighting, but Abraham Lincoln said, "You know, I need you in Congress," and so he did. He came back, but you know, interestingly, Garfield, he was frustrated with Abraham Lincoln. He especially as a young man was very, very passionate about abolition and about the Civil War, and he wanted things to happen faster than Lincoln. You know, Lincoln, and I think in this case, I think Lincoln was right. You know, Lincoln sort of steady course, trying to keep the country together, and Garfield was just, you know, this young, passionate man saying, "Listen, this is obviously this tremendous evil. We need to end it right now." And so that was an interesting dynamic to me.
Well, you've written another terrific book, Candace. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for writing it. It's just fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the interview. Thank you.
Yeah. Candace Millard. The book is Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your calls. Be with you again on Monday, bright and early at 9 for All Things Political. Great conversations ahead.